Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. The sounds you're hearing are the sounds made by wagons rolling across the veld because we're going to join the trekkers, who've mostly now stopped trekking. For the trekkers, the promised land was at hand. The high veld, parts of Mariko, the northern Limpopo region, the Waterberg, the slopes of the Witwatersrand into the low veld, the Free State, with its rocky outcrops, its vastness, and the dusty Transaranja. In the Caledon Valley, Moshweshwe was monitoring the Dutch speakers, who were now speaking a combination of languages, morphing into the Taal Afrikaans. Further east, King Mpandi Kaas Senzangakona of the AmaZulu had been keeping an eye on the colonial developments while indulging in expansion policies of his own. This period, 1854 and 55, is like a fulcrum between epochs. The previous lifestyle of Southern Africa, pastoral and rural, was running its final course, the final decade before precious mineral discoveries were going to change everything. Let's stand back for a moment to observe the world before we plunge into the goings-on in the Boer republics. Momentous events had shaken Europe, a succession of revolutions which had somehow swept around Britain but never swept Britain away. This is more prescient than it appears. These revolutions are forgotten by many. They're an echo, but in the echo we always hear the future. The 1848-1855 revolutions were precipitated by problems of imperial overload in Europe. In the late 1840s into the 1850s, France and Russia had been annexing and colonizing. In France's case, it was Algeria. In Russia's case, it was Poland. Moscow declared martial law there. The Tsar was fighting discontent. Financial crises had triggered attempts by many nationalist local entities to overthrow what they regarded as hateful external powers. Liberal nationalism was also sweeping the world, and the American Constitution was on everyone's lips. The Prussian monarchy in the Polish region of Silesia had deployed troops to quell unrest and attempting to quash uprisings in Schleswig-Holstein and Saxony. The Austrians were quelling Hungarians and impressing sentiment in Lombardy and the Veneto of northern Italy. The Bourbon elites of Naples had unleashed their mercenaries, the Swiss Guard, to crush opposition in Sicily. Liberal nationalist movements were spurred on by the hatred of the external military presence and in some cases even an alien religious faith. Attempts at raising taxes across Europe had also triggered uprisings. And yet, Great Britain had avoided these uprisings to some extent. Yes, there had been the swing riots of the 1830s caused by a decline in agricultural prices and wages, also the introduction of cheap Irish labour and new threshing machines. Yes, the Peterloo Massacre of 1816, but that was a distant memory. So too the extremely violent Gordon Riots of 1780. Globally, the British Empire was rolling on. London was snapping up even more land and colonies. Hong Kong had been annexed in 1843, the Indonesian territory of Labuan in 1846, South Africa's Natal in 1843, the Orange River in 1848, but of course, they rescinded this in 1853. Other areas recently annexed included the Gambia, 1843, Afghanistan, 1842, and the massively important Indian states of Sindh in 1843 and Punjab in 1849. The empire now paused in the mid-century to draw breath. Most of these newly minted acquisitions were what were known as crown colonies, including the Cape. Crown colonies were presided over by a governor who traditionally was a military man and most often a veteran of the Napoleonic Wars. While the mutterings and murmurings of discontent continued in Britain, globally they were much more visceral. The British establishment was attempting to use distant empires to ease the burdens at home, but this partially backfired by the middle of the 19th century. Riots and rebellions had broken out in Ceylon and the Ionian Islands, which were scattered off the western coast of central Greece. There had been Boer uprisings in the Free State, and a major mutiny had been put down in the Punjab in India. In Canada, martial law had been proclaimed in Montreal, and the Parliament building had been burnt down. Campaigns of civil disobedience against the British attempts at importing convicts had broken out in the Cape, in New South Wales and Australia, and Van Diemen's Land, or Tasmania, as we know it these days. Drastic government retrenchment was taking place in England. Jamaica and British Guiana were technically bankrupt, and the British government took steps around the world to introduce constitutional change in its colonies. And here, swept by these international winds, were the Boers and other South Africans. Copies of the American Constitution were cropping up in the oddest places, like the back of Boer ox wagons or inside the churches alongside the Bibles. American missionary Daniel Lindley, who you heard about in our earlier episodes, the man from Ohio who had started out life in South Africa as a missionary based with Mzilikazi of the Amandebele in Mariko. Lindley had copies of the Constitution distributed to the Boers. When the Boers and Mzilikazi had fought it out on the veldt in 1836, Lindley had fled along with the Boers. He had first administered to their religious needs in Pietermaritzburg, but was a travelling priest, a predikant, an American who had learned the kitchen Dutch being spoken in South Africa, Afrikaans. This is important. There was a direct link between the American Constitution and South African concepts, or what democratic rights were, which you can track all the way to the 1994 new constitution. The American Constitution resonated amongst the Boers with its "we the people" tenor and its concentration on the right of the individual. At this stage of world history, both the Boers and the Southerners in the United States believed that blacks were inferior and should be cast in the drawers of water and hewers of wood biblical description of the children of Ham. The Boers weren't even in favour of the Khoi Khoi and the Coloureds having the right to vote in the Cape, let alone to retain any rights in the Transvaal Republics or the New Free State. The fundamental trigger for the Great Trek was the British insistence that all men should be governed equally under the law of the Cape. At this point, 1854-55, America was still a slave-owning republic. There were tensions rising, though, leading to the vicious civil war in 1861, but the idea of a constitution reinforcing the values of democracy while entertaining slavery was not a contradiction in the eyes of the southern states of America, nor the Boer republics of South Africa. The economy of these new little South African states was somewhat shaky, a mixed picture. The departure of the British troops from inland, particularly the Free State, had caused a short-term depression in the dorps. But outside of these little villages, land prices rose because of the perceived stability that emerged after Mashweshwe subdued raiding Kurana and rebel Basutu under Sekonyela. It was thought that sheep farmers, who were beginning to make good profits in the Eastern Cape, would head upland. These inland republics were pastoral in nature and dependent for their corn on the Basutu living along the Caledon Valley, as well as their English neighbours and the Boers who lived further north. Traders from the Cape could be found scattered through this territory, selling gunpowder and basic supplies, while the Transvaalers would travel south after bartering corn from the Basutu, bringing their tobacco along with meal they ground and dried nuts to exchange for sheep and wool from the Griqua and the English. There was almost no hard cash in the region at all. Most of the coins brought by the voortrekkers had been spent. The biggest weakness built into these new republics was political. They had no experience of settled government. They had been voortrekkers, after all. Now they had begun to put down some sort of roots, and this weakness showed up in all its glory. The southern half of these republics, the Free State, had no government at all until 1848. The rule of the Windburg Republic was nominal, interspersed thereafter by 6 years of British rule once Harry Smith had annexed the Orange River sovereignty. When the British left in 1853, the first Volksraads had tried out the law of Moses, but the Old Testament is not exactly the place to find proper ideas about government. The law of Moses includes Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy, full of rituals, sacrifices, customs, and civil law, and many, many thou shalt nots. So the next best was to fall back onto a summary of the American Constitution. Article 1 vests all legislative powers in the Congress, the House of Representatives and the Senate. Article 2, the executive power in the President. Article 3 places judicial power in the hands of the courts. Article 4 deals in part with relations among the states and with the privileges of the citizens so important for the Boers. Article 5 was the amendment procedure in Article 6, public debts and the supremacy of the Constitution, while Article 7 stipulates that the Constitution would become operational after being ratified by 9 states. Would the Boer republics ratify their constitution? And what would it be? This document served as a useful template for the Voortrekkers. So they watered it down, copied it. A Volksraad of 29 would be elected, which was the highest legislative power, a kind of senate. Whites could be elected onto this Volksraad once they'd lived in the Free State for at least 6 months. And 50% would have to retire every 2 years to create new opportunities for new faces. Now, this is a very fast turnover. You can see how a few practicalities began to creep in, which made this concept rather unworkable. Still, for the first time since Piet Retief in the mid-1830s, a real civil executive emerged. There would be a state president elected by universal suffrage, universal Boer suffrage, of course, male only. He would hold office for 5 years unless 75% of the Volksraad voted to remove him. The state president was a bit like the speaker in the House of Congress, except in this case, he could not vote. The president would have to sit in the assembly and help pass sentence on bad people. He'd also be a judge, and it would be his role to formally declare war, but only after the Volksraad had ratified this. Ratification would be a majority of one. His cabinet, or executive council, consisted of 2 officials, technocrats, if you like, and 3 Volksraad members. In his war council, his Kreisraad of commandants and veldcornets would be elected by the burghers. If a war broke out, the Kreisraad would elect a commandant general. But there was no commandant general in place if there was no war. This was to avoid the conflict of interest in the past, where the commandant general and the leader of the Volksraad ended up vying for top dog position. Landdrosts, magistrates, would be appointed by the Volksraad across the territory, sitting with the Heemraden in common law matters, with a jury of 9 in criminal cases. Heemraden were members of a council that helped local magistrates govern rural districts before the British took over. The word Heemraden comes from the Afrikaans word heem, meaning farm or village or home, and raad, meaning council or councilman. The Trekkers followed Het Roomsch Hollandsch Recht, Roman Dutch law. And so this Volksraad duly elected their first state president for the Free State, Josias Philip Hoffman. But what of the Transvaalers? Well, followers of rugby who are Free State or Natal or Western Province supporters will be pleased to hear that the Transvaal / Lions were in utter chaos. There was almost no form at all. Politically, it was void of organisation. There were at least 25,000 Boer men, women and children living north of the Vaal by the mid-19th century, and they had no constitution. It was the Potchefstroom Republic, centred on Potch, which had 100 houses and a kerkstraat 4 kilometres long. 700 people lived in the town. Schoemansdal, to the north, was the basis of ivory trade, much bigger and richer than Potch. The Schoemansdalers looked down their noses at the Potchefstroomers. It was an ancient biblical posture. It was hunters and shepherds versus farmers, Cain versus Abel, the clash between the settled and nomadic societies. One of the dirty little secrets of South African life in the mid-19th century was how successfully these new arrivals, the Trekkers, had decimated the elephant, the rhino, the lion, the leopard, the crocodile, and hippo populations. Schoemansdal was living on borrowed time. We tend to fixate on the wheelings and dealings of societies and peoples, forgetting that the environment had been plundered by hunters who gleefully destroyed the goose that laid the golden egg. In some ways, the Timaeus discovery of diamonds and gold would be the only saving grace of these animals. Without alternative ways to make loads of dosh, elephants would have been shot to extinction in South Africa. Near Schoemansdal was Leidenbach, a sleepy village, tiny, and further east was Urgstadt, and that by now was almost deserted. Exodus and Joshua were the books of choice for most folks across the Vaal. The stories of coming from the land of Egypt, aka the Cape, out of the house of bondage. The contempt for the Cape Dutch, their brothers back in the colony, was blatant. The Kapenaars were indulgent, said the Trekkers, these hardy men of the northern veld, while the Cape Dutch were self-indulgently delighting in flesh pots. The men of the Republicans of the Northern Veld, the hardy men, had pursued the promised land into the wilderness and been punished by Jehovah. They had been killed and fought their way into the paradise they had found, this promised land, while in the south, the Kaapenaars had been bought off by the accursed English. Trade in the north was barter. Slaughter cattle were herded down to the Cape, and it was on these cattle that the Boers relied. Like their forefathers who had traded cattle with the VOC who bought the animals to feed their sailors and soldiers and passing ships in the 1600s, 1700s. So too the Boers of the 1800s traded their cattle with the British buyers who fed their passing ships and soldiers. Some trekkers of the north had established orchards of oranges and peaches, particularly in the southwest of the Transvaal, while the women tended the vegetables in gardens. The men preferred to hunt, travelling away from their homes for months at a time on grand hunting expeditions, or heading over the hill to visit neighbours for a spot of coffee and a shot or two of brandy. Cattle farmers the world over are pretty similar. Beef on the hoof implies a very tough lifestyle, which at first glance appears simple to an outsider. What has been forgotten is just how tough it was. Malaria was rampant in the Magaliesberg and throughout the lowlands north of the Witwatersrand Ridge, the area around Brits and Rustenburg, down into the Lowveld. It was a death trap for many. This was like the land of Egypt, plague-ridden and surrounded by existential threats like other people, the Basutu, the Tswana, the Venda, and these people were now surrounded by the existential threat of the trekkers. What compounded everything were personal, political, and religious feuds within the Boers themselves, and these roughly coincided with the geographical divisions. The landscape will always bear witness to human vicissitudes overlaid by ego and culture. Like the African groups in their midst, the Boers were players on a landscape that forged their entire existence. Whatever they thought of themselves in terms of Christians versus the local black heathens in the phraseology of the day, the reality was both were chiselled by time spent inside this landscape. Andries Pretorius and the men of the southwest, held by the Natal Constitution and Piet Retief's policy of a single republic with a strong central government, empowered by accessing a port in the direction of Zululand and independent of the Cape churches, the Dutch churches. But the eastern Transvaalers of Urgstad subscribed to what they called the 33 Articles and wanted incorporation into the Cape Synod when it came to religion. They did not want Piet Retief's solution. The 33 Articles were adopted by the Potchefstroom Burgersraad on the 9th of April 1844 and confirmed 4 years later on the 23rd of May 1849 by the Unified Volksraad of the Suid-Afrikaanse Republiek at Daartepoort. At the time, Boers referred to this as the Algemene Bepalingen en Wetten, general provisions and laws, but not as their constitution. Ordinary citizens constantly referred to Algemene Bepalingen en Wetten, underpinned by the laws of Moses. Hendrik Potgieter died on the 16th of December 1852, the day of the covenant, and Andries Pretorius, the last of the first Voortrekker leaders, died at the age of 55, 7 months later. Would peace now break out between these two sets of followers? Apparently not. Both sets of Volksraads appointed their respective sons, Martinus Pretorius and Piet Potgieter, to succeed their fathers. This was hereditary succession, a kind of royalty within the independently minded Boers. But wait, it is at this moment that fate intervened, because Piet Potgieter was drawn into a commando raid in which he was to become the only fatality. The story begins with a hunting party seeking white gold, ivory, and elephant hunt. It also begins with a massacre and ends with the siege of a cave. The Nael Rivier was always disputed territory, particularly since Chief Makapan claimed the river. Nael means Nile, and the Boers had renamed this river for all sorts of important reasons. The river is a tributary of the Limpopo and found in the northern part of the Springbok Flats. By the way, in 1860, only a few years after this incident, a group of Boer zealots known as the Jerusalem Gangers trekked to this flooded plain with its wide river flowing lazily north towards the Limpopo, and they believed they'd arrived at the Nile River and the biblical promised land, the real Nile. So the Jerusalem Gangers settled nearby and named their town Nielstroom. Back to Piet Potgieter. In September 1854, Piet's uncle, Veldkornet Hermanus Potgieter, or Groot Hermans, as he was also called, decided to go hunting ivory near the Nael Rivier. Hermans was not only imposing but aggressive and violent by all accounts. But that was inside an area ruled by two chiefs, Makapan, who was a man of great personal courage, who led the Kakana. These were an Ama and Ndebele-linked group. Also nearby was Mankopani, who was the chief of the Langa tribe, and that's where a bit of confusion starts to rock up. Mankopani was known by various names, including Mahopani and Mapela. Mankopani is also depicted as a fierce leader and an exemplary fighter who survived multiple expeditions against him by Dutch farmers. And Mankopani lived to the ripe old age of 72. He was never subjugated by the Boers in his lifetime. So the die was cast in a way. Groot Hermans, a towering, glowering man, versus Mankopani, a fiery firebrand. And into the mix, also, Makapan, who was up for the scrap too. And there are two main versions of what happened. I'm going to relate both, then we shall try to extricate fact from fiction. Next episode, we shall conclude the saga with its terrifying cave fighting and ultimate South African symbolism. The Langa and Kakana people first experienced trekkers in 1837 when Louis Trichardt entered their territory. From then on, a steady trickle of Boers could be found inside Langa and Kakana land. The area we're focusing on is close to where the town of Port Gietersrus would be founded later, the modern town of Mokopani. We can begin to connect our histories here, Makapan, Mokopani, Mankopani, Port Gieter. At first, relations between the Boers and the Langa and the Kakana were cordial. The Kakana were centred around 13 kilometres south of Port Gietersrus, the Langa 25 kilometres north, but then they shifted a little bit west by the time of our story in 1854. Friction grew as the trekkers began to encroach on the chief's land, and when they seized workers and cattle, the tension escalated. For example, in 1847 and 1848, trekkers raided the Langa and the Kakana, making off with cattle, women and children. Mankopani reported this to local missionaries, including Robert Moffat. There were attempts at reconciliation. These failed. The Boers had concluded a treaty with the English recently, which apparently gave them control of the area north of the Vaal, but the terms were somewhat hazy. The treaty supposedly banned the Boers from raiding local African tribes, but they could defend themselves from attack. This was the grey area. When was it aggression? When was it self-defence? The Boers, on their side, had defeated Mzilikazi of the Amandebele, who was the African overlord of this region, and therefore the Boers presumed they were the ultimate power on the veld. Makopani was the chief of the Kakana and linked to the Amandebele. And for the Boers, this meant that Makopani was defeated because his chief had been defeated, Mzilikazi, and Makopani should accept the new rulers. It was a misconception that was going to fuel the coming siege, where the stories are full of flaying, decapitation, murder, intrigue. The trekkers were growing frustrated by these two chiefs of the Kakana and Langa. They were apparently brazenly ignoring the obvious that the Boers ruled. Piet Potgieter had warned both chiefs when he heard they were buying muskets and ammunition. They ignored him. Piet Potgieter had made it his life's work to disarm all Africans he came across. And by November 1854, things developed a particularly vicious edge. The clash took place in this part of the Waterberg, which resulted in a spiral of killings, the massacre of over 20 trekkers, then the massacre of hundreds of Kakana and Langa people, and a siege in a cave that is epic. Next episode, I'll take you through these two versions of events. We'll peel away the scab of history and stumble into this cave, Makapansgat, a dank and dark cavern where sounds are amplified, mystery swirls, and the odor of death hangs like a curtain of tears. Caves are veiled in eternal shadow, whispering secrets of ancient despair. And inside, there is an air of sinister foreboding that can chill the soul. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform that helps elevate its visibility. And you can head off to desmondlatham.blog. I'm going to load a summary of these episodes. You can email me from there too. Until next, goodbye.